12. Number 7. Just as ordinary soldiers know, without being shown the battle orders from headquarters, whether they are part of the main offensive or a supporting action, so the 300 Zeks in the Marfino Sharashka had correctly deduced that Number 7 was the decisive sector. No one was supposed to know Number 7's real name, but everybody in the Institute did. It was the Clipped Speech Laboratory. Clipped was an English word. Not only the engineers and translators in the Institute, but the fitters, the turners, the grinders, perhaps even the deaf and slow-witted carpenter, knew that the original models for the installation were American, though officially they were ours. This was why American journals with diagrams and theoretical articles about clipping, which were on sale in newsstands in New York, were here given serial numbers, stapled, classified, and, to frustrate American spies, sealed up in fireproof safes. Clipping, damping, amplitude compression, electronic differentiation, and integration of random speech, it produced an engineer's parody of human speech. It was as if someone had taken it into his head to dismantle New Athos or Gurzuf, put the material in little cubes in matchboxes, mix them all up, fly the lot to Nyerchinsk, sort them out, and reassemble them precisely as they were before, reproducing the subtropics, the sound of the surf, the southern air, and moonlight. This was just what had to be done with the speech, reduced to little packages of electrical impulses, and, what is more, it had to be reproduced not only so that it could be understood, but so that the boss could recognize the voice at the other end. While prisoners in the camps gritted their teeth in the struggle for existence, those in the Sharaskas lived in something like luxury. And the authorities had long ago made it a rule that if a project was successful, the Zeks most closely concerned with it received all that they could desire, their freedom, a clean passport, an apartment in Moscow, while the others received nothing, not a single day's remission of sentence, not even 100 grams of vodka in honour of the victors. There was nothing in between. So those prisoners who had successfully acquired that special tenacity that seems to enable a prisoner to cling to a mirror with his fingernails tried to get into Number 7 as a springboard to freedom. One who succeeded was the brutal engineer Markushov, whose knobbly face radiated readiness to die for the ideas of engineer Colonel Yakonov. Others of the same stripe also found their way there. But the perspicacious Yakonov also recruited Zeks who had not volunteered. One such was Amantai Bulatov, a guileless Kazan Tatar with big horn-rimmed glasses and a deafening laugh, who was serving 10 years as an ex-POW, and for his alleged link with Musa Jalil, an enemy of the people. They jokingly called Amantai the firm's oldest employee. After graduating from the Radio Institute in June 1941, he was tossed into the Smolensk debacle. Because he was a Tatar, the Germans extracted him from the POW camp, and he began his practical work on the shop floor of the Lawrence Company when its management was still signing letters with a Heil Hitler. Then there was Andrei Andreevich Potapov, an expert on ultra-high voltages and the construction of power stations. He had landed in Marfino because an incompetent bureaucrat had made a mistake when consulting the Gulag's card index. But Potapov, a real engineer and an indefatigable workhorse, soon found his way around at Marfino and was irreplaceable in the handling of apparatus for the precise measurement of radio frequencies. There was also engineer Kharabrov, an outstanding radio expert. He had been assigned to Number 7 at its inception, when it was just one team among others. He had wearied of it recently, and made no effort to keep up with its furious tempo. Mamurin was getting just as tired of him. Finally, a special order as swift and urgent as a lightning flash had produced from a punitive brigade in a hard labour camp near Salekharda, a gloomy prisoner and engineer of genius, Alexander Bobinin, who was immediately set over all the others. Bobinin had been plucked from the jaws of death, and now Bobinin was first in line for release if their project succeeded. So Bobinin worked hard, keeping it up after midnight, but with such an air of dignified disdain that Mamurin was afraid of him and did not dare make the sort of remarks to him that no one else was spared. Number 7 was the same sort of room as the acoustics lab, but on the floor above it. It, too, was littered with apparatus and a medley of furniture, but there was no ramshackle, soundproof box in a corner. Since Yakonov appeared in Number 7 several times a day, it did not treat his arrival as a descent from on high. All that happened was that Markushov and other toadies made sure that he saw them and bustled around more briskly and cheerfully than ever, while Potapov, to make himself invisible, used a frequency meter to stop a gap among the apparatus on a rack that screened him from the rest of the laboratory. He had worked without a break, paid all his debts, and was now quietly fashioning a lump of transparent red plastic into a cigarette case, intended as a Christmas present for someone. Mamurin rose to meet Yakonov as his equal. He was not wearing blue overalls like the other Zeks, but a suit of expensive cloth, yet even this made his haggard features and his bony frame no handsomer. The expression on his sallow brow and his bloodless lips, the lips of one not long for this world, was meant to signify pleasure, and Yakonov read it right.
"Anton Nikolaitch, we've readjusted to every 16th impulse, and it's much better. Come and listen in. I'll read you something."
Reading and listening in were the usual way of testing the quality of a telephone circuit. The circuit would be changed several times a day by the addition or subtraction of a unit, and adjusting the articulation every time was laborious, too slow to keep up with the ideas of the engineers on design, and it was not worth trying to get rough figures from the forbidding science now monopolized by Reutemann's foster child Nirjin. Mamurin and Yakonov, obedient as usual to a single thought, had no need of questions or explanations. Mamurin went first to the far corner of the room, turned his back, pressed the receiver to his cheekbone, and started reading from a newspaper into the telephone, while Yakonov stood by the stand with the control panels, put on the earphones plugged into the other end of the circuit, and started listening. Something dreadful was going on in the earphones. The sounds made by Mamurin were fragmented by crackling, rumbling, and howling. But just as a mother gazes lovingly at her ill-favored babe, Yakonov, instead of tearing the earphones from his tortured ears, listened harder and decided that this new, horrible noise seemed rather better than the horrible noise he had heard before dinner. The new noise was not live colloquial speech, but a measured and exaggeratedly precise recital. Mamurin was reading an article about the high-handedness of Yugoslav frontier guards and the effrontery of the butcher, Rankovic, who had turned a freedom-loving country into one great dungeon, so that Yakonov easily guessed the bits he couldn't hear, realized and as quickly forgot that he was guessing, and became more and more certain that audibility had improved since dinner. He naturally wanted to share his joy with Bobinin. The heavily built, thick-set prisoner with the defiantly shaved head, you could please yourself how you wore your hair in the Sharashka, was sitting nearby. He had not turned around when Yakonov entered the lab, but instead crouched over a long strip of photo-oscillogram film, measuring something with a pair of dividers. This Bobinin was the least of God's creatures, a non-existent Zek, the lowest of the low, with fewer rights than a kolkhoznik. And Yakonov was a bigwig. Yet Yakonov could not bring himself to distract Bobinin, however much he wanted to. You can build the Empire State Building, train the Prussian army, elevate the hierarchy of a totalitarian state higher than the throne of the Most High. But there are still people whose moral superiority defeats you. There are common soldiers whose company commanders fear them, laborers whose foremen tremble before them, prisoners who strike fear into their interrogators. Bobinin knew all this, and deliberately took such a stand with his superiors. Whenever Yakonov talked to him, he felt a cowardly urge to pander to this Zek to avoid upsetting him. He was angry with himself, but he noticed that everybody who talked to Bobinin behaved in the same way. Yakonov interrupted Mamurin and took off his earphones.
"It's better, Yakov Ivanovich, definitely better. I would like Rubin to listen in a bit. He has a good ear."
Somebody, once upon a time, had gotten from Rubin the answer he wanted and had remarked upon his good ear. Others had repeated this unthinkingly and come to believe it. Rubin had landed in the Sharashka by chance and earned his salt as a translator. His left ear was like everybody else's, but he was a little deaf in his right as a result of shell shock. He had to conceal this after his hearing had been praised. The fame of his good ear had given him a firm footing in the Sharashka, and he had subsequently dug himself in still more securely with his magisterial work on the audio-synthetic and electro-acoustic aspects of Russian speech. Rubin was summoned from the acoustics laboratory by telephone. While they were waiting, they listened in again, some of them for the tenth time. Markushov, eyes strained, brow knitted, held the receiver briefly and abruptly pronounced it better, much better. He had known it would be. Readjusting to every 16th impulse had been his idea. Bulatov could be heard all over the lab, shouting that they must arrange with the encoders to readjust to 32 impulses. Two obliging electricians, Lyubimichov and Siromacha, shared a pair of earphones, almost pulling them apart. Each of them listened with one ear and enthusiastically confirmed that it had indeed become more distinct. Bobinin went on measuring his oscillogram without raising his head. The black hand of the big electric clock on the wall jumped to 10:30. In every lab except number 7, they would shortly be finishing work and handing in secret journals to be put in safes. The Zeks would be going off to bed and the free employees running to catch buses, which were infrequent at this late hour. Ilya Terentyevich Khorobrov, keeping to the back of the lab where the bosses could not see him, lumbered over to Potapov behind his shelf rack. Khorobrov was a native of Vyatka, from its most godforsaken corner near Kai, bordering on the land of the Gulag, thousands upon thousands of versts of marsh and forest, an expanse greater than France. He had seen and understood more than most, and things had sometimes become so unbearable that he felt like standing under one of the loudspeakers out in the street and banging his hand on the iron post. The unremitting need to conceal his thoughts, to stifle his sense of injustice, had bowed him, giving him a forbidding look, etched deep lines around his mouth. The time came when he could no longer suppress his longing to speak his mind. At the first post-war elections he had crossed out the candidate's name and written a crude obscenity on the ballot form. That was a time when houses could not be rebuilt and fields went unsowed for lack of working hands. But a whole team of ace sleuths spent a month studying the handwriting of every elector in the district, and Khorobrov was arrested. He went off to the camp, naively rejoicing that there at any rate he would be able to speak his mind. But the camp was no free republic either. With stool pigeons all around him, Khorobrov learned to hold his tongue there, too. Common sense demanded that he should bustle about as busily as the others in the anthill that was number 7 and earn, if not his release, at least a comfortable existence. But the loathing inspired in him by injustice, even when it did not affect him directly, had reached such a pitch that he no longer wanted to live. He slipped behind Potapov's shelf rack, bent over his table, and quietly suggested that they should leave.
"Andreich, it's time we cleared off. It's Saturday."
Just at that moment, Potapov was fixing a pale pink catch to the translucent red cigarette case. Head on one side, he admired his work and asked,
"What do you think, Terentich? Do the colors match?"
Receiving no reply, neither approving nor negative, Potapov gave Khorobrov a grandmotherly look over his wire-framed spectacles.
"Why tease the dragon?" he asked. "Time is on our side. Any Pravda lead article will tell you that. We'll evaporate as soon as Anton leaves."
He had a habit of separating his syllables and reinforcing the important word in a sentence with a gesture. By this time Rubin had arrived in the lab. Rubin had not been in the mood for work all evening, and right then, at 11 p.m., the only thing he wanted was to get back to the prison as quickly as possible and to lap up some more Hemingway. But he arranged his features to express keen interest in the improved quality of number 7's circuit, and would have no one but Markushov as his reader, because his high-pitched voice, with its basic tone of 160 hertz, would come across less clearly. This approach put his expertise beyond doubt. Rubin donned the earphones and repeatedly commanded Markushov to read louder or more quietly, or to repeat phrases that he himself had invented to check particular sound sequences. In the end, he gave it as his verdict that by and large there was a tendency to improvement, that the vowels came across just marvellously, that the unvoiced dentals were not quite so good, that he was still worried about the fuzzy edges of zh, and that the consonant group fsp, so characteristic of the Slavic languages, didn't come across at all and needed a bit more work. There was an immediate chorus of delighted voices, so the circuit was an improvement. But Bobinin looked up from his oscillogram, and his deep voice boomed a mocking comment.
"Nonsense! It's one step forward, one step back. What we need is method."
His unwavering stare reduced them all to embarrassed silence. Behind his shelf rack, Potapov was gluing the pink cat to the cigarette case. Potapov had spent every day of his 3 years in Germany in prison camps. He had survived, mainly thanks to his skill in making attractive lighters, cigarette cases and holders from garbage and without tools. Nobody was in any hurry to leave work, and this on the eve of their stolen Sunday. Khorobrov straightened up. He placed on Potapov's table the things that had to be put in the safe, emerged from behind the rack, and moved unhurriedly toward the door, passing the crowd around the clipper. Mamurin paled and barked angrily after him.
"Ilya Terentich, why don't you have a listen? Where do you think you're going, anyway?"
Khorobrov, just as unhurriedly, turned around and answered with a twisted smile, stressing each syllable.
"I would have preferred not to mention it out loud, but since you insist, I am at present on my way to the lavatory, or shall I say the John. If all goes well there, I shall proceed to the prison and go to bed."
In the scared silence that followed, Bobinin, who was hardly ever heard to laugh, guffawed. This was mutiny on the high seas. Mamurin took a step toward Khorobrov as though about to strike him.
"What do you mean, sleep?" he shrilled. "Everybody else is working, and you want to sleep?"
With his hand on the door handle, and scarcely containing himself, Khorobrov answered,
"That's right. I just want to sleep. I've worked my 12 hours according to the Constitution, and that's enough."
He was about to explode and add something irremediable when the door opened and the duty officer addressed Yakonov.
"Anton Nikolaich, you're wanted urgently on the outside phone."
Yakonov rose hurriedly and went out ahead of Khorobrov. Shortly afterward, Potapov also turned off his desk lamp, transferred his own and Khorobrov's confidential papers to Bolatov's desk, and limped neither quickly nor slowly toward the door. A motorcycle accident before the war had left him lame in his right leg. The call for Yakonov was from Vice Minister Selivanovsky, summoning him to the ministry, to the Lyubyanka, at 12 o'clock midnight.
A dog's life.
Yakonov went back to his office, dismissed Nerzhin, offered Verenyov a lift, put on his street clothes, returned to his desk with his gloves on and under Nerzhin, right off, added Khorobrov, ditto.